We got a great number of questions. I think we have over 25 questions. So we won't be able to address them all, but we've tried to choose some themes that came up in a number of them. The first set of questions, Arthur, you touched on in the second set of your remarks. It's about what a fundamental change of consciousness looks like. So this is the first question. And I'll just open it up to all three speakers, and you can decide who'd like to respond. The Baha'i Faith proposes a fundamental and spiritual shift in the values of humanity in order to bring about lasting changes that would be reflected in both governance and individual behavior. What do you think the role of religious institutions might be in helping to change the values of humanity? Somebody else asks, what is a fundamental change of consciousness? Have you had it? What is it? How will it be accomplished? How do we do it? And what are some practical steps we can take to shift the hearts and minds of people to view the earth in a more sustainable and spiritual context? So I'll turn it over to you.
Can I take a stab at that consciousness question? I think we're all evolving on this. Stand up so you can see me. Sorry, we didn't move the podium we meant to. The issue of consciousness, I think we're coming to it from a couple of different angles, at least I am. And one of the propelling motivators for me has been climate change. I think that climate change has been a wake-up call to many of us about the limitations of life on the planet and our responsibility to each other and to future generations. And so my motivation for change is coming from an awareness of the science as well as an awareness of the faith's teachings about humanity. I'm going to pass it on.
That's a very open question. I'll just try to take a stab at it. I had it, part of it. So I don't know if I've had a change of consciousness. I've had a sort of expansion, I guess, of the consciousness that's been in me for a long time. I remember when I was about 12 years old, a time I was in the woods in northern Connecticut, having just somehow or other getting a reorientation, you know, to the earth and thinking about it very differently at that time. I was by myself, and I was in a place where there's some young pines, and having a sort of different sense of myself, and beginning then is when I can date the feeling I've had my whole life of being appalled, basically, at the way this civilization conducts itself. And I took the train from Montreal to Toronto 3 or 4 months ago, and I remember thinking, well, if you looked out at this landscape from an Aldo Leopold point of view, he says that anybody with an ecological conscience lives in a world of wounds, right? And it seems to me that the whole path between the two cities was wounded, right? There was nothing there that hadn't been treated with disrespect, or almost nothing. I suppose there were a few places. So my original response to this was to try to buy enough of America to save itself, to save it from itself. But that proved to be, I think Ted Turner actually tried to do that, but he had a lot more to work with than I did on a professor's salary. It took me about 20 years to figure out that wasn't going to work. And then I started working with the land trust movement, and then I remember there was a sign on the on Route 50 as you approached the Bay Bridge. I used to live in Washington and Annapolis. It said, "Progress is our project." It was put up by the Department of the DOT of Maryland, MDOT, Maryland Department of Transportation. Well, what they were doing was they were widening Route 50 so you could get to the beach faster, paving over, destroying wetlands, farmland, creating places where shopping centers would spring up near towns and everything. So I realized it was the opposite of progress. It was just a wholesale destruction. And that's when I started to work on economics.
I think with respect to the role of religion, it's an evolving role. When I was at the Stockholm Conference in 1972, representing the Baha'i International Community, we had a meeting among all representatives of different religions there, and all the others were saying, we're trying to get the attention of our hierarchy, our leadership. They don't know about this issue. The Baha'is had sent two ecologists to the conference and, you know, issued a statement on human values and the environment, and were already actively involved in this area. Then there has been an evolution. There was the Summit on Religions of Conservation in 1995 at Windsor Castle, where Prince Philip invited the ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople and the Archbishop of Canterbury and other significant leaders there. And there was clearly a growing awareness, at least at the top in religions, that this was an important issue to be involved in. Now we will be seeing the launching of action plans on climate change from all the religions in the next few months. So clearly, religion has become aware that it must apply its ethical values in this area, and the structures of all the religions are beginning to mobilize themselves to do that as one of the key ethical challenges of our time to which all of their principles reply. With respect to changing consciousness, I think this is the kind of thing that everybody goes through individually and never stops going through it. We know, of course, in the Baha'i faith that learning is a lifelong process, that you never stop growing spiritually. I certainly, if I look at my own track record, more than 60 years I've been gradually expanding my awareness and understanding of this, from Baha'i children's classes all the way up through summer schools and on to serving the community and the Baha'i international community in various ways. So I think that all of us have to find our own path in changing our consciousness and suddenly being aware that in fact spiritual principles can take us in new directions, that we need to always go back to the spiritual mentor and say, am I doing things right in my material life? Have I actually developed a convergence between my spiritual awareness and my daily lifestyle? And that's a challenge each of us, particularly those living in North America, have to go through, to question each thing that we're doing and say, how does this relate to my own growing consciousness of the spiritual responsibilities we all have for the planet?
Thank you, Arthur. Thank you, all three of you. We have to take just one moment to say that if somebody has a Florida state license plate and their car is parked on the fifth floor, it's about to be towed. So if that's your car, go get it. We had two questions about the absence of indigenous and aboriginal perspectives in this area. So this question is, when will science and academia allow them their rightful place and recognize their vital part in the stewardship of the earth? And then there's a set of questions about the types of economic changes looming on the horizon. What will investing look like for individuals, and are there avenues of investment that we should look into now? Another question about, what does a non-consumerist economy look like? And then a question that asks about the system of capitalism. So the free enterprise system, capitalism, has been a tremendously liberating force over the past two centuries. Its failings are largely human and moral, not systemic. The market system is not inherently inconsistent with Baha'i teachings and could be embraced as a powerful tool to solve environmental and other challenges. Can you comment on this?
Well, thank you for the exciting questions. I think with respect to that, to the last comment on the free enterprise, the market system, the mechanisms of the market are reasonable mechanisms if they were applied in a spiritual context. The theory of the market requires perfect information between the buyer and the seller to fix an appropriate price. How often today do you get perfect information? Usually you manipulate the information to get advantages in the market. It's the values underlying the system that are wrong. After all, the Bob was a merchant. He was buying and selling. But when he didn't sell something at the highest price and waited and sold a bit lower, he felt that justice required that he provide the highest price the person did it for. His values were different, even though he was working in the market system. So I think that we have recognized that what we need to change are the values. And in fact, the market mechanism would work much better in a spirit of consultation between, looking for the just solution between a buyer and a seller than it would in the present competitive, trying to get an edge over the competition, kind of approach that it takes. So what we need to change is much more the values underlying the way the economy works rather than necessarily the specific mechanisms by which it operates, although it does have other problems in that area. With respect to the absence of indigenous or aboriginal perspectives, clearly this is an area where the Baha'i faith, with its universal membership, including members of many aboriginal and indigenous groups, is extremely important. I myself spent a decade working in the Pacific Islands with the Pacific Island peoples, helping to ground their approach to the world society in a set of better values than that of the Western system. And in fact, we built a whole educational program on those values and the fact that they were far ahead of the Western economic system in understanding how to deal with issues of sustainability and the environment. I think that where we haven't done enough of this, perhaps we need to listen more to those who are much more developed than we are. We may be developed in the material sense in North America, but we're certainly seriously underdeveloped in a social and spiritual sense. And other so-called indigenous peoples are far ahead of us. We have much to learn from them in their approach to the stewardship of resources. So I think there needs to be certainly a better exchange, recognition that there's a sharing here. It's not developed or developing. We each have things to learn from the other, and it's only when we bring all of that together that we'll be able to find a way forward. And in fact, I mentioned Vincent Brown earlier. He was raised on Dakota Reservation. He was extremely sensitive, wrote many books about the indigenous traditions, and did his best to try to bring that dimension in to our approach to both the environment and to our approach in the Baha'i faith. So there's a few comments on those very important questions that I think that are fundamental to how we approach this issue.
So there's a lot of questions in there. I'll just take a couple of them. On the question of indigenous or First Nations peoples, no question in my mind that their insights are essential. We do use those traditions a lot in the book, and we have programs where I teach at McGill that cooperate directly with the Mohawk, or developing one cooperating with the Mohawk community just south of Montreal, and also a program going back 10 years with the Cree in the James Bay region that's given access of lots of students. And my primary motivation in that is to get students exposed to a non-Western metaphysics and theology. So that's been very successful with that objective. On the question of capitalism, I don't know, that doesn't seem to be practiced anywhere that I've been able to find. The greatest theft in human history has just been accomplished on behalf of saving capitalism by impoverishing you and your children. So there's definitely good things about a free enterprise system if we had one, which is that it internalizes risk and brings about prudent behavior. So we should, in the future design of a system, we need to keep those goals in mind, but that certainly isn't what we have. On a practical matter, what would a society like this look like? It's a huge question to which I don't have complete answers, but one thing that should be done is to take back the right to print money. The federal government of the United States and most other countries have given this away to their central banks and to the banks and credit card companies. So I believe it's correct that in the United States, only about 2% of the money supply is actually created by the Treasury. The rest is created by the Federal Reserve, which is, by the way, not a Federal Reserve. It's actually a private entity, and by banks and credit card companies. So Arthur was mentioning last night $500 trillion in derivatives. Well, where did the dollars come from that got to denominate all of those assets or alleged assets? Because they got made up out of nothing, basically. They're just created by banks. So if you go to a bank and you want to borrow, let's say, $100,000 to buy a house, the bank doesn't have to have $100,000, it just has to have the right to create $100,000, and it gets that from the Fed. It's called fractional reserve banking. A bank has to have a little percentage of what it loans you, but doesn't have to have anything like the whole amount. So if you got rid of fractional reserve banking, for instance, or even diminished it, then if I go to the bank and I want to borrow $100,000 to build a house, Arthur has to have lent the bank $100,000 so that I can use it, right? So in the old days, the bank took somebody's money, paid him or her some interest on it, and then lent the same money to somebody else. Well, that constrained consumption because I can't build, under the present system, Arthur can build a house and I can build a house, but without fractional reserve banking, if he's loaning the money, he doesn't have it. I have the money, and so only one house gets built, right, instead of two houses getting built. So you ratchet down consumption. You also give back to the government what's called seniorage, right? The right that when the government prints a dollar bill, it doesn't cost a dollar to print it. It costs probably a couple cents, maybe or even less. When the government spends that on, let's say, improving highways or mass transit or something, it gets 100 cents of value from the company it buys the subway car from, for instance, right? So the government has earned, in a sense, 98 cents on its dollar. So you get a tremendous source of public revenue, right, just by taking back the right to create money. So that's that kind of reform and kind of rethinking is what we're going to need to get on the right track. But that would be fought tooth and nail by the beneficiaries of the present basically irresponsible system.
And I just had a couple of thoughts on the indigenous question. Indigenous people, interestingly, are one of nine major groups that have been identified by the United Nations for participation in the discourse on sustainable development. Every year at the Commission on Sustainable Development, indigenous peoples are represented there. And their views are valuable and sought. And obviously, we can draw much inspiration from indigenous views like the ones that I included in the reflection piece when we got started. The other question, I think there was a question, maybe I'm imagining it, about consumption and sustainable consumption. And I thought I would just throw out that it's interesting that World Watch Institute, in its next State of the World report, is doing the feature on sustainable consumption, a topic that's very relevant to our discussion this morning. And included in that publication will be a chapter on religion and sustainable consumption. And Gary Gardner, the colleague that I mentioned in my talk, who had written about religion so much, contacted us some months ago about this question and wanted to know what the Baha'i approach was to consumption. And did we have any programs that discouraged consumption? And I had to think about it, but I thought about it and actually gave him back some information about an institution of the faith called Hukukula. It's the right of God. Now, this is a very important feature of the Baha'i faith. It's a feature for voluntary giving. It's entirely dependent on the will of the individual. It requires us to distinguish between our needs and our wants, and to give a portion of our excess back to God. And actually, it goes to the institutions of the faith, and it's used for the betterment of humankind in general. Gary said that this was the most profound response that he had heard from a religion to date. Now, this is not a campaign, if you will. This is an institution and a law of the faith. So it's something that each of us, I think, is learning about simply because it was only made applicable across the Baha'i world in 1992, but it has profound implications for the future.
Thank you. We're going to try to fit in two more questions. There really were so many excellent questions, and we're having a tough time getting to all of them. But let's ask these last two, and then maybe if people have questions, we can talk to some of the speakers afterwards. This is a question for Peter Brown. You critique the notion of God creating humankind in his image. The Baha'i view is that all created things reflect divine attributes. Human beings are capable of reflecting all these attributes. Would this conception of image be more in line with the notion of grace and good stewardship that you talked about? And then somebody's asking about the concept of dualism, which you mentioned is partly responsible for our present dilemma. How can we bring in the idea of pluralism and balance that has been lost to the attention of the masses? And then finally, there's a question about climate change. In the U.S., there's a well-organized movement fueled by right-wing talk radio and certain political organizations attempting to demonstrate that human efforts on climate change are minimal or non-existent. How should we go about addressing these perspectives? So I'll give you a chance to answer those few questions, and then we'll wrap it up for this morning.
Can you read the first one again and the last one?
Sure. First one and the last one. You critique the notion of God creating humankind in his image. The Baha'i view is that all created things reflect divine attributes. Human beings are capable of reflecting all of these attributes, if they choose so. I think that's what it says. Would this conception of image be more in line with your notion of grace and good stewardship?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I'll take a stab at it. The reason I use the Henry Beston quote is that there's ideas of multiple perfections in there. I have a friend who's used to teach with me at the University of Maryland. His job of his idea when he was flying somewhere, he'd calculate if the plane door opened and you were sucked out, would you die first from freezing to death or from hitting the ground? first, and he thought that was an interesting question to analyze. I actually rather not even know the answer, but it is, just in case you're curious, you freeze to death first, so you hit the ground like a block of ice. So that was his idea, you know, fun, basically. Well, and he was very good at that kind of question, but owls are very good at seeing mice in the dark, right? And ravens osprey are very good at seeing fish underwater, right? So cockroaches are very good at hiding in the corner. So there are multiple excellences. I don't see any reason to privilege the excellence that we have. I think we should be respectful and care about the things we're good at. Differential equations, foreign languages, those are things I'm not good at, but I would like to be good at. But there's no reason to say that the excellence of an osprey or the excellence of an owl isn't also an excellence. I find all the pretenses of the glorious thing is man. I would say the glorious thing is life, right? And various living forms exhibit the perfections that are possible in the universe. And we're not the end. We will go extinct as a species. Will all excellence the supreme thing in the universe go extinct at that point? Not in my view. Something else will happen. Something else may be happening elsewhere. It's 100 billion planets. 100 billion galaxies, 100 billion planets, you know, I mean, who knows what's happening? So I think that's pretentious, actually, to hold that view. And I don't think it's required by religious faith, either. I think you can have faith and confidence in the future without privileging humanity in it.
I'd like to talk about the question about the well-organized movement trying to demonstrate that the human effects of climate change are minimal or non-existent. This really gets my hackles up. I mean, if you study the science, friends, it's a no-brainer. And you have the scientists, the International Panel on Climate Change, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's top scientists have reached consensus with certainty that climate change is happening. Now, the evidence is all there, and it's easy to find. There are some very interesting efforts to kind of debunk the debunkers, if you will. There's a website that has videos, and I'm at a loss. I can't quite remember what it was, but it's video responses to the myths that are being perpetrated by those that are discounting the science. And if you get in touch with me after the conference, I can probably give you the link to that. But I just think the science is so clear, and there's so much evidence. And I have a colleague in the National Council of Churches who runs their eco-justice campaign, and her approach is they don't pay any attention to these people anymore. There's too much work to be done with those that understand and can get going on this issue. Why waste your time, I think, is her sentiment. And then, finally, there is a fantastic high school teacher somewhere in the Midwest that has put up a number of very entertaining videos on the web. And his argument basically is, we win whether climate change is real or not by converting to a green economy. We get rid of our dependence on fossil fuels. We generate all kinds of new business from the new approaches to a green economy. And anyway, if we take no action, we have tremendous risk. If we do take action, and it is a problem, then we've done the right thing. If we take action and it's not a problem, we're still going to come out ahead.
Just following on from Peter's comments on that issue, you know, having worked in the United Nations for many years, struggling with this kind of problem where in the scientific literature, you know, 98% of literature says climate change is happening, if not more. In the popular press, particularly in America, it's 50-50. You know, they're trying to sort of treat the two sides of the argument equally in some way. And of course, then you find that there are vested interests that have a conjugation interest, you know, to try to present disinformation. Between the oil industry, which wants to preserve the sale of oil and doesn't want the link with climate change, the tobacco industry that sees science as making a link between tobacco and, say, lung cancer, and therefore wants to discredit science for that reason. Some of the fundamentalist, religious groups that think that science, says that evolution has happened when everybody knows the world was created 4,000 years ago, and therefore, and in any case, since Christ is returning soon, we can forget about the earth, the environment doesn't matter because we're all going to be going to heaven. There is a conjugation of interests which has been trying to sell a different message to the American people in particular. You don't see the same thing in other parts of the world, as it is here. So I think all you can do there is to become conscious that there is manipulation going on, try to investigate the truth independently, and look at spiritual responsibilities as a better foundation than necessarily what you're reading in the media every day to try to counteract the kind of brainwashing going on, particularly within American society, that is not, that you're sort of surrounded by it, drowning in it, and therefore it takes a certain amount of effort to vaccinate yourself against the messages you've been bombarded with that may have no scientific foundation, but have a very strong foundation, invested interest trying to protect their particular perspective. But I think just finally, to close this the issue of dualism and how do we bring pluralism and balance, behind that dualism is a strong element of ego, of man sort of saying, we are the top of creation, the environment is something outside of us, we dominate. It's a misinterpretation, perhaps, of some biblical phrases, or sometimes even a mistranslation. But if we approach this issue with humility, the kinds of spiritual values that the Baha'i teaching can see are so important, that can help us to stand back from that and recognize that we it's on that basis of spiritual values we can find the necessary balance to address these problems and find solutions that meet our needs and the planet's needs together. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're just getting, let's give a round of applause, good idea, to our presenters. You know, dear friends, the House of Justice has talked about three areas of work for the Baha'i community. So one of those areas is the expansion and consolidation of the Baha'i community. The second is the work of social action in its larger form, social and economic development projects, in smaller forms, small types of community action. And then the third is contributing to the discourses of humanity. And I think what we've done here this morning is to really exercise our faculty of looking at science, looking at academics in this field who have done amazing work, and then looking at the Baha'i writings and what that has to say. And hopefully this will lead us to go back to our communities and engage in some type of action and continue to learn about this. Bring it into our Ruhi study circles, into our work with our neighbors, into our home visits, and think about how we can contribute to the discourses that are taking place at the local level, how we might engage in some type of local action. So I think this is what the organizers of the panel had in mind. I want to thank the IEF and the Association for Baha'i Studies for their hard work in putting together this panel this morning, and again for our guest speakers who did an amazing job.